afternoon. We are happy to welcome the Mineral Point High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. These students are here with us with a program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. In this program, we invite students from across the state to come and listen to an oral argument. And we send them materials regarding the case. And after the oral argument, most of the students come in the morning. After the second oral argument, the students meet with a justice, and the discussion is on the procedures of the case, not the substantive matters. Everyone is invited to attend. The the Mineral Point High School students did not come in time for that meeting, but I've been advised that they can stay for several minutes after this argument. And if Justice Prosser is willing, can speak with them about the procedures of the case. Counsel are invited, as well as everyone else in the courtroom, to come and hear that. This program is a national award-winning program as part of the court's reach to the public, to understand the public's concern about the court system and to help the public understand how this court operates, as well as the trial courts. The students have received a summary of these cases that we're hearing. If anyone else would like a summary of the case, if you'd raise your hand, the deputy marshal will give you a summary. In the interim, then, let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley, and to her right, Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. Now, with those introductions made, we're going to do a rundown on the lineup. This is a petition for review and a cross-petition for review. And so on the petition for review, which involves the insurance company and related claims, Mr. Weiss will have 15 minutes and Mr. Anderson, 20 minutes. On the cross-petition, which involves the liability of Mr. Wenham, right? I'm sorry, I should have said Mr. Weiss has 5 minutes of rebuttal on the first part, right? So that is a total of 40 minutes, right? My math is right. Then on the cross petition, we have 8 minutes for Mr. Lauer, 10 minutes for Mr. Deutsch, and 2 minutes in rebuttal for Mr. Lauer, making a total of 20 minutes. And the total for all the arguments then totals 60 minutes, which is the standard time. Any questions? Any changes? All right? We go. Mr. Weiss.
Chief Judge, members of the court, my name is Monty Weiss. With Attorney Alan Deutsch, we represent the plaintiffs. May it please the court. The plaintiffs are asking for this court to reverse the order of dismissal and remand this case, directing the trial court to enter judgment against National Union for two reasons. The first reason is that National Union failed to provide proof of why its protocol failed and how the failure were the actions of a reasonably prudent insurance company employee. And second.
That's the excusable neglect issue, right?
That is correct. Okay. And second, that under Section 631.01 of the Wisconsin statutes, any one of the four enumerated bases standing alone is sufficient to permit a direct action against an insurer.
This Counsel, for me, that's the issue that really grabs me, okay? So if you wouldn't mind starting almost in reverse order, excusable neglect is one of those things where it's discretionary. That's just not the tougher issue for me. Having said that, do we need to reverse Kennison in order to rule for in your favor?
No, I don't believe you do. And simply put, the reason you do not have to reverse Kennison is Kennison was correctly decided. It's just that the language they used was a little too broad in the dicta.
That's what they say about some of my opinions, too. The correct opinion is just the language was wrong. You know?
In this case, the dicta of Kennison is just a touch too broad. Okay. But Kennison was correctly decided. In Kennison, you and the parties in Kennison, the issue that they presented by way of their appellate briefs and the issue they defined was whether the policies were issued or issued delivery in the state of Wisconsin. That was the only issue that was presented at the appellate level. In our case, we have several reasons why Section 631.01 of the statutes provides that any one of the four enumerated bases is sufficient. The wording of the statute. When this court analyzes a statute, it takes a look at the words of the statute and applies the plain meaning. If there isn't any ambiguity, we simply apply the terms. Here, common English grammar dictates. We have the statute that provides that it applies to policies that are issued or issued for delivery in the state. Then a comma. Then on property ordinarily located in this state. Then a comma. Then on persons residing in this state, provided they resided at the time the policy or group certificate was issued, comma. And then the big or on business operations in this state. Common English grammar says we apply these in a disjunctive. Second, the construction simply makes sense. It makes sense to apply it this way. Wisconsin is interested in regulating certain types of insurance contracts, those contracts that actually have an impact on Wisconsin residents. If you apply Kennison, the dicta in Kennison, what you end up happening is eliminating or ignoring three-quarters of the statute. You ignore the you stop at issued or issued for delivery in the state of Wisconsin, and you're done. You don't look at the rest. And that doesn't make sense because you've ignored many words the legislature had put in the statute for a reason. And finally, it is unworkable to use National Union standard because National Union's argument essentially engrafts an and. It puts a word in the statute that doesn't exist. Under National Union's argument, you need the policy issued or issued for delivery in the state and one of the other three bases. There's no and in that statute. That statute has three commas and an or. So by the terms of that statute, that's why it makes sense.
This whole statute, all the chapters in the six, I shouldn't overstate it, but in the 600s generally, was the result of a long study by a legislative council, if I am correct, if I remember my history on this. And the note here, which is a legislative council note, says that 632.24 on direct action is edited, but it's the meaning wasn't changed. And I've read the notes, but have you gone back to the history of the Legislative Council to see what they meant?
I did not go back to the history.
They met monthly or weekly or quarterly for a long time, and their minutes will show discussions of this.
I would agree that they do. The reason we didn't go back is we don't look at legislative history when we're analyzing a statute to determine whether it's clear and unambiguous. And the unambiguous construction of this statute, when you look at the language of it, it's unambiguous. There is no reason to consult legislative history to interpret it.
But at least some of the members of this Court say, well, you can consult legislative history to satisfy yourself, and that you can use legislative history to conform, to show that it conforms to the plain meaning. Now, as to the plain meaning, you cite a federal case recently, a 2005 case, that says what you say. But I think an earlier federal case looked at plain language and came up with the same result that Kennison did.
I don't recall which federal case.
Okay, my notes show it as Vilke versus Iowa National Mutual in Eastern District, so I'll check it out again. But I tell you, when I read this cold, I read it the way Kennison read it. When I read your materials, I said, sure, I can read it that way too. So then I said, hey, I can read this two ways. And sometimes people don't use commas in the same way, right?
That's true.
Okay, but what's your response to that?
But the materials that we've cited showed that the common English grammar use of commas is the way the statute was written to show that it is in the disjunctive and that each component part would stand alone. In addition, there are unreported cases that have interpreted the statute in the way the plaintiffs have advocated. So it seems to me that the statute really has one way to be construed, and that is in the disjunctive, which each one of the bases being separate and independent.
Yes. Could you, just for my benefit, could you read the statute eliminating words you don't think apply so that you get the coverage you want?
Could we read this, so that I understand the question, could we read the statute and ignore language in the statute?
Well, I mean, you're not relying on every word in the statute.
If you were highlighting what you want us to get out of the statute, what would you read?
Yes,
that's
what I would highlight is really the language where really that whole first paragraph, the language itself is in this chapter, it's on all insurance policies and group certificates delivered or issued for delivery in this state, then the comma, then on property ordinarily located in this state, comma, on persons residing in this state. And then the last paragraph has a comma. I'm sorry, the last phrase has a comma. It says, or on business operations in this state. When you read that.
Which of these disjunctive provisions do you want applied in this case? That's another way of asking the question.
Yeah.
Got it?
We have business operations in this state. We have a policy issued by National Union to a Minnesota corporation,
so
TLC.
What you want to do is read this 631.011 to say this chapter and chapter 632 apply to all insurance policies on business operations in this state. That's how you're reading this statute.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Under the facts of this case, I'm sorry I misunderstood, but yes, under the facts of this case, TLC has business operations in the state, and the policy was issued to cover business operations in the state. That's the independent basis of the statute. That phrase is the one that's operative for this case.
Yeah, but there's an except as to business operations. Do you fall into the exception?
No, we don't fall into the exceptions, and the exceptions are if the business is subordinate or incidental to the operations of the insured, in this case, TLC. TLC would have to show that, not TLC, but National Union, would have to show, present evidence that TLC's operations in this state were incidental or subordinate to its main operations elsewhere. For example, if it did 1% of its business here, 0.5%, some small incidental part of its operations.
Now, let me just try once more here. You're saying that what we should look at on this statute is this chapter and chapter 632 apply to all insurance policies on business operations in this state. That's what you're saying.
Yes.
What is your opposing counsel going to say, and how are you going to rebut what he has to say?
Based on their argument, they would argue that, National Union would argue that you would have to have the policies issued or issued for delivery in this state and business operations in this state. There's no and in this statute. This statute doesn't provide for that. The statute is clear, unambiguous, and set off in disjunctives. So that would be their argument and the response. Thank you.
Reading that, I want to just stay with the words, if I may. What did you do with group certificates? This chapter and Chapter 632 shall apply to all insurance policies and group certificates? Where does that word?
Group certificates would be a policy of a certificate of health insurance. That's how those would, that would relate to group certificates of insurance if that were, because group policies, group health policies would apply. They'd be covered within the scope of this statute. But that's not the issue here. The issue is the policy of insurance issued by National Union.
So if this case were involving a group certificate, you would read it, this chapter and Chapter 632 shall apply to all group certificates on business operations in this state.
Yes.
So you're saying delivered or issued for delivery in the state is standalone. That's one way. A second way is on property. A third is on persons. And fourth is on business operations.
Exactly.
Right?
Okay. Exactly.
Do you have any arguments that you want to advance beyond the clear language of the statute?
Well, the
statutory
interpretation? Sure. The clear language of the statute, and frankly, it simply makes sense. We want to be able to provide, Wisconsin is going to want to regulate certain types of insurance transactions, ones that protect Wisconsin citizens. If we have a policy issued to Wisconsin residents, Wisconsin is going to want to regulate that and imply its statutory scheme of protections.
But you're looking to purpose. What are you looking to then? I mean, we have, of course, our mantras on statutory interpretation. And making sense should be an umbrella, but it doesn't appear in the mantra.
That is true. But the way we apply our policy, the way we interpret our statutes is simply by the clear language of them if they're unambiguous. And then if you take a step back and look at how those policies, how the statute makes sense, it, in my opinion, would then crystallize the rationale for applying it in that manner. It certainly would make sense that Wisconsin would have an interest in regulating policies issued to its citizens. If there are substantial business operations, it goes hand in hand, for example, with business operations in the state. For example, if Continental Casualty, for example, a California insurance company, issued a policy to GM located in Michigan for what was then at least substantial business in the state of the Janesville plant. Under National Union's construction, if someone were hurt at the Janesville plant, they would be unable to sue GM because clearly they were out of business at the time, and they would not be able to bring a direct action claim against the carrier because under National Union's construction, the policy wasn't issued in Wisconsin. It wasn't delivered in Wisconsin. That's the prerequisite for National Union's argument, as opposed to what, again, makes more sense and is consistent with the statutory interpretation. There are business operations in this state. That's what we want to regulate. Someone is injured. They should be able to have apply the direct action statute of our state. Yes. I see my time is up.
The accident.
Well, that's all right. Justice Prosser.
The very tragic accident here occurred in Wisconsin. Suppose the Casper family had been residents of Illinois, but the accident occurred in Wisconsin. How would the statute apply then?
We have the Caspers coming up from Illinois in Wisconsin. Under the Janesville or the GM hypothetical I put forth, we would not have a policy issued or issued in delivery in the state of Wisconsin. We would not have the policy issued to a resident of the state of Wisconsin. We would not have business. We would have business operations in the state. The policy would be issued to, presuming the GM, we would have business operations in the state. So we would be able to do that. We would not have, arguably, the GM plant would constitute property in the state as well. So we would be able to use one of those four, one of the two of the four bases.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Several minutes in rebuttal, five to be precise. Mr. Anderson, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Chief Justice. My name is Ross Anderson, and I'm appearing today on behalf of National Union Fire Insurance Company of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. National Union is the excess carrier for TLC, one of the defendants in the case. And I'm assuming the same admonition applies to me that I should start off my discussion on Kennison. Kennison presents this court the issue that it's raised, and I should go back and say procedurally.
I would suggest you leave some time for excusable neglect. I note that in your briefs, the predominant number of pages are an excusable neglect.
I would think that's true.
Well, I counted them up. I'm mathematically inclined. And it's 24 pages versus I think it's 19. Really, don't hold me to it, but I think that's a rough count if they're not equal. So you should leave some time for excusable neglect.
Well, I will be happy to do so. The Kennison issue came up after the trial court found that National Union's reason for failing to answer on time constituted excusable neglect. Our answer was then accepted as the motion to extend time was granted, and we then moved for summary judgment based on Kennison because the insurance policy at issue in this case, our excess policy, was not issued or delivered in the state of Wisconsin. It insured a Minnesota company and was issued from out east and was delivered in Minnesota. Both the trial court and the Court of Appeals followed the Kennison decision and affirmed the summary judgment that had been granted by the trial court. The issue that's presented is a case of statutory construction, and really I think boils down to whether there are three disjunctive clauses or four disjunctive clauses in that statute. The thing that I think Mr. Weiss and the appellants gloss over is that Kennison not only looked at 631.01, Kennison also looked at its interrelationship with 803.04, the permissive joinder of parties statute, which also allows the insurance company to be sued directly if the policy of insurance is not issued, if the policy of insurance is issued or delivered outside of the state. Under the permissive joinder statute, the plaintiff still has the right to sue the insurance company, but it is not a direct action under 631.01. That was the holding in Kennison. Kennison involved a situation where the policy had not been delivered or issued for delivery in Wisconsin. The Kennison court read that as being the first requirement of the statute, and then the other three clauses were disjunctive. So the policy had to be delivered or issued for delivery in Wisconsin, and there either had to be property located in the state, persons residing in the state, or business operations in the state in order to create a sufficient nexus for the Wisconsin Insurance Code to regulate that insurance policy and, in our case, sustain a direct action against the insurance company under Section 632.24. In an effort to protect Wisconsin litigants and give them direct access to the insurance company, not on a direct claim, but to name the insurance company as a permissive defendant so that the second action did not have to be started to enforce the judgment against the insurance company, 803.04 includes in subsection 2, and I'll read it, I quote, if the policy of insurance was issued or delivered outside this state, the insurer is, by this paragraph, made a proper party defendant only if the accident, injury, or negligence occurred in this state. Now, if the plaintiff's reading of Kennison was correct, there would have been no reason for the legislature to focus that provision in the permissive joinder statute solely on the issued or delivered within the state. That's the only requirement, and it's the seminal requirement of 631.01, as the Kennison court found. And coming out of Kennison, or following Kennison, and the circuit court followed it here, what happened was there was a ruling that there was no direct action because the policy was not issued or delivered here, but National Union remained a party defendant in the lawsuit under 803.04, the permissive joinder statute. If the plaintiffs are ultimately successful in obtaining a judgment against our insured TLC, they will not have to go through the process of starting a separate action to enforce the judgment against TLC under the policy of insurance. Those two statutes, according to the Kennison Court, and I believe, need to be read together to determine whether or not the issuance or delivery of the policy in Wisconsin is the critical component of 631.01. Now, a point was made in one of the amicus briefs, and I'll have to give credit to it. In addition, it was not touched on by Mr. Weiss. The Kennison decision has been around for 12 years now. The legislature certainly has not done anything to change the statute, to change 631.01 or 803.04, for that matter, in relationship to this issue in the 12 years following that decision. We believe that those two statutes, when read in conjunction, make the reading of the Kennison statute, or the Kennison decision, make the reading of 631.01 clear that the policy first has to be issued or delivered in Wisconsin, and then you go on to the other connections with this state, be it property, persons, or business operations in the state, in order to fall under the Wisconsin insurance regulatory scheme.
Mr. Anderson, what about the fact that the Court of Appeals, in more than one case, if I remember correctly, has tried to tell us that the Kennison case was wrongly decided, but that they had no choice but to follow the Kennison case since it's precedent that they can't reverse? How do you respond to some of the criticisms that have come from the Court of Appeals directly?
Well, I'm only aware of one case that said that, although that was a comment that's in the record here because the trial court had the same observation in this particular case. I guess my response to that is you have to read the statute and the statutory framework to determine if Kennison is correct. Mr. Weiss obviously has his arguments as far as the reading of the statute. The statute could have been punctuated better. I would have put a colon after issued or delivery in this state, colon, and then either subparagraphs A, B, and C, or the disjunctive clauses setting it off there. From the way the statute is written, it is not entirely clear, I think, that issued for delivery in this state is clearly a standalone provision. I think it is a standalone provision when you look at what the statute is trying to accomplish. When you read it in conjunction with 803.04, where they highlight that provision, I believe that confirms it's a standalone provision. But I can understand where the Court of Appeals at least wanted some guidance from this Court with respect to that statute.
In fact, the Court of Appeals in the Finder case, it wasn't concerned with 631.01 as we have focused on thus far, but rather was focusing on language as otherwise provided in the statutes, as I understood the Finder certification. They said, hey, look, you got 631.01, and it says in sub C, as otherwise provided in the statutes. Then they took us to 632.24, which is the direct action statute, and they said there's nothing in the direct action statute that appears to permit, that would limit the ability for a direct action against an insurer. There's no limitation as to whether or not it is in or out of the state delivered. And then they went to 80304 and the permissive appeal, and they said, look at that last sentence, particularly in 80304, and when dealing with negligent insurers in sub 2A, and then they said, bingo, bango, bongo, which translated means that Kennison was probably wrongly decided.
I assume bingo, bango, bongo is something that comes in from the Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court. We usually don't get to read that, but
it's a legal term.
Yes. In looking at those three statutes and the interrelationship of that statute, of the statutes, it's clear that there's nothing in the direct action statute itself, 632.24, that has anything to do with any of the limitations that are in 631.01 or in 80304. So the direct action statute is there. Now, 631.01, because of where it is and the lead-in, it applies to all insurance policies in this state. So I believe that 631.01 overrides the direct action statute, and to the extent it sets up limitations, those limitations apply to the direct action statute.
But what does sub C of 631.01 mean, as otherwise provided in the statutes? The finder certification said, 632.24 is a statute. It's not provided in 631.01. So it's otherwise provided, and you don't have that limitation. That's what they advanced in their analysis, anyway.
Well, the only other statute that I'm aware of that references the issue, and keep in mind, 631.01 applies to the entire insurance code, not just to direct action. We're looking at it through the rifle scope of just direct action. But 631.01, I believe, limits 632, because 632.24 allows direct action against insurance companies based on insurance contracts, and 631.01 contains some limitations that apply to all insurance policies delivered or issued for delivery in this state. So you have the limitation of 631.01. The other reference then falls back to 803.04. I'm not aware of any other statutes, but just because 632.24 does not contain the same limitation, it says, as otherwise provided in the statutes, there's nothing in the direct action statute that says those limitations should not be read into it.
No, I mean, that's true. The Court of Appeals in the finder certification said there's nothing to suggest that they should be treated any differently in state or out of state. You know, it's just a matter of which is the glass half empty or half full, how you want to read that.
Yes.
The
yes.
Note to 632.24 says they didn't intend to change it from the old statute. Under the old statute, could you have sued National directly?
Under the old direct action statute?
Because that's what the note says. It says it doesn't, that this change of language, but that it doesn't intend to change. Am I misreading that? I thought that's what it said, that the statutory note.
Your Honor, I will have to plead the same failure of research. I did not go back and check legislative history, nor did
this
I check.
This is right in the statute. It says, well, I'm reading it from Chapter 375, the legislative enactment. Note, this section is adapted from 204.30(4), much edited, but without change of meaning. Section 631.15 sub 2, which doesn't seem to be in here at the moment, makes it unnecessary to include the last sentence of the prior 204.34(4). So I read 632.24, according to the note, to say, hey, it doesn't change its meaning. So I would say, but I didn't research this, is if I could have sued National Union under the old 632.24, I can sue them now. Because although 631.01 says it applies to everything,
it looks like the intent of the drafters here was not to change the direct action statute. I mean, you know, I agree with you that you have to read the note to come to that conclusion, and that if you just read the statute cold, you come to the conclusion you did.
What I don't know is what the predecessor to 631.01 was, because that was adopted in 1975, and I don't know what, if anything, there was as a predecessor statute.
Yeah, this whole, all of these chapters, of, I'm overstating it, but 631, et cetera, dealing with insurance contracts is all part, although pieces were adopted at different times within the 1970s, it was, they're all part of a series of statutes as a result of a special committee, and I'm under the Legislative Council, and it was, the drafter was Spencer Kimball, who was then chair, who was then dean of the University of Wisconsin Law School.
And I note that both 632.24 and 631.01 were adopted in 1975. So what existed for predecessor statutes?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure there was something that governed contracts during the legislature, but I don't know. All right, you've got about 5 minutes or less. Do you want to talk about excusable neglect? Well, you better answer Justice Prosser's question first.
Justice Prosser's question.
One more question. Let's assume that I agree with your interpretation of 631.01, that there are three disjunctive things. Why would the legislature have written it that way as opposed to the way you're opposing counsel? What's the policy reason? What objective would the legislature have had?
I think that the policy reason and the objective there is that they were attempting to establish a level of contact with the state of Wisconsin in order to justify our regulation of insurance policies. I don't think the legislature could have written the insurance code as governing all policies everywhere, unless there was some connection with Wisconsin in order to give us some control over those policies. So I believe that the underlying thought under 631.01 is how much of a connection with this state do you need to have in order to fall under the regulation of 631 and 632 and the subsequent chapters. 80304 was a little less concerned with that. They only were concerned about people injured here or negligence incurring here in order to at least give people the right to maintain, to join the insurance company as a permissive defendant and not have to go through the process of the second lawsuit to prove up the judgment against the insurance company.
It seems to me all of those last three disjunctive clauses involve the state, don't they?
Involve the state?
Yeah.
Involve either operations or persons going on here in the state, yes.
Properties here, the business here, the people reside here.
Right.
Isn't that ample contact?
They were looking for policies issued or delivered here and those things. And that level of contact.
I want to follow up on that. I just don't understand if you have a business operation in the state that you're insuring, making money from, have customers, you know, maybe this is the only one in the whole state, but, you know, what is the policy for not allowing a direct action, but rather requiring a lawsuit, a threshold lawsuit?
What? I'm sorry, I'm not sure I'm not sure I understand what you mean by a threshold lawsuit.
Suing the insured.
For under direct action, you mean?
Yeah. not suing the insurer, suing, having to sue the insured, and then trying to bring in the insurance company otherwise.
Well, I think that the policy underlying the direct action statute is to give plaintiffs the right to sue the insurance companies directly,
sure,
whether or not they want to sue the insured.
I'm not making myself clear. As long as the insurance company is insuring a business that has operations in the state, I don't understand the policy reason for not allowing a direct action against the insurance company. What is the policy reason? Now, I'm not saying it should be. You know, you got to look at the words of the statute. What do they say? And that's public policy. But what sense does it make?
I think that I would take it to be a level of connection with the state. And there is a subsection there that exempts out incidental business, incidental or subordinate operations in the state of Wisconsin. That's not enough to rise to that level then. So they're clearly looking at some level of contact with the state. And if the policy is issued here or delivered here, and if there's a business operation here that's not incidental or subordinate, then you have enough to justify a direct action against the insurance company. Because understand, every insurance policy that's written prohibits direct actions like that. Wisconsin is unique in terms of allowing this type of situation, so that they are at least establishing enough notice connection with this state in order to justify completely trampling over a provision that is in every insurance policy that I'm aware of that's issued in this country. That's what I think the policy justification is for it. And an insurance policy on a large corporation may or may not designate out where the company has business operations. In this particular case, it's a trucking company. Is it applying to trucks being driven through the state, or is there actually an operation within this state? Same thing with products liability insurance, where you get into something similar to jurisdictional analysis, I guess, as far as how many products come here, and does the defendant have some reasonable knowledge that they're likely to be sued in Wisconsin? This is at least giving, if policies are issued or delivered here, and there are these other connecting factors, then the insurance company is essentially put on notice that the provisions in your policy are going to be ignored, at least to that extent. And I believe the circuit court properly exercised his discretion in connection with the default.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Weiss, according to the federal cases, at least the one you cited, which is Engelbretson, you could join the insurer as a proper party defendant, provided the insured is also a party, right?
Yes.
Could you get the insured as a party here?
Did we get the insured? Yes, they are a party.
So what's the fuss? Why didn't you just, once this was raised, why didn't you just say, hey, okay, we're going to join them as a proper party defendant? Why are you making a fuss about whether it's direct action or proper party defendant, right?
One very simple response is,
okay,
what if TLC goes out of business?
All right.
I need to have my clients to be able to take advantage of the laws set forth in this state by the legislature to have a direct action claim against the carrier, to proceed directly against the carrier and obtain a judgment against that carrier.
All right. I dig that. But TLC isn't out of business, is it?
Not yet.
Okay.
I don't know whether – I would have not thought GM would have gone out of business.
But you agree that you could sue direct action or bring the insurance company as a proper party, provided the insured was a party?
Yes.
Okay. So it's not like you're cut out of this totally, of it suing the insurance company.
I can bring them in, and they will be a party.
Right.
They will be a proper party defendant under 803.04.
And you're saying that if you couldn't bring him in under direct action, and then the insured died without an estate or something else happened as a corporation, you'd get stuck unless you could come under direct action.
Exactly.
That's why you're fussing.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
I wanted to know why.
Fair enough. Just a couple of points. What I heard from National Union's counsel were the terms of a sufficient nexus between the insurance policy in the state of Wisconsin. A level of connection with the state was another phrase I heard. Some connection with the state, I heard. Enough to justify a direct action. That's what counsel asserted in argument as to the interpretation of 63101. In other words, what's the justification for that? As long as there's some justification, some connection with the state. Well, again, reading the statute in the disjunctive, National Union really would have to concede that that makes sense. What is the level of connection, a sufficient nexus? Well, an insured residing in here. Property ordinarily located in this state. Insureds who reside in this state or business operations in this state. Counsel touched on the concept of minimum contacts, jurisdictional type analysis. Well, again, let's take a step back and look at that statute. The statute has an exception. The statute will not allow for the jurisdiction over the assertion of or regulation of National Union if the business operations are not substantial, if they are subordinate or incidental to the insured's operations in this state, if what they do in this state is incidental or subordinate to their main operations, 63101 doesn't apply. So if you want to look at the minimum context type of, or analyze 63101 in that type of context, then again, the plaintiff's interpretation makes sense. Any one of those four bases provides the level of connection, the sufficient nexus, some connection with the state of Wisconsin. Briefly shifting over to the excusable neglect argument, there is no evidence of excusable neglect in this record. While the trial court does make a discretionary ruling, it has to have the right facts, and it has to be focused on the right facts in order to do so. When we look at all of the submissions by National Union, what we don't have is what happened when Charles Lamphere didn't respond back to the memo that Susan Cartagena responded. What did Ms. Cartagena do? What did Attorney Weisinger do? There's nothing in this record to establish excusable neglect. They simply, from all indications, did nothing. Unless the court has any other questions of me.
Well, they had a procedure. They sent a letter, right, saying it's your job to answer this complaint, right?
Not quite, but...
All right, but close. And then they said, confirm receipt of this letter, didn't they?
Yes.
And then there was no confirmation of receipt of the letter, right?
My time is up. Permission to answer?
Yes.
Thank you.
All right.
That's
right. And then there was no... When was there follow-up?
That's what we don't have. Any evidence that they followed up, that the reasonably prudent National Union employee, Attorney Weisinger, followed up or had her assistant follow up. That memo that this court, that you pointed out, Chief Judge, it says Mr. Lamphere has to acknowledge that complaint in one of two ways. If his department was to handle it, he was supposed to fill out that memo saying received by, date by, and who in his department it was referred to.
Right.
And if it was not being handled by his department, he was to immediately contact Ms. Cartagena.
Right.
Mr. Lamphere, the evidence shows that, and the record is clear, Mr. Lamphere never got it. So what did Ms. Cartagena do? What did Attorney Weisinger do? There is nothing in there to say that they did anything. And if they did nothing, that is not excusable neglect. That is carelessness. It is not excusable neglect.
They obviously had enough care to say, you've got to acknowledge receipt here and tell us what you're doing.
Exactly.
But then they didn't follow up. That's your big point, isn't it?
Exactly.
Okay. You made it.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We're now going to hear from Mr. Lauer, representing Jeffrey Wenham, who is the CEO, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Counsel, you've got 8 minutes.
Thank you, members of the court. My name is Robert Lauer, and I represent Jeff Wenham in this case. My time is short, so I want to just briefly touch on Oxman's and then move to the foreseeability arguments. Frankly, the Court of Appeals didn't respond to the foreseeability arguments that were contained in the briefing, and so I'd like to talk about that. But before I do...
Does your foreseeability go to the public policy doctrine?
I think it does in two respects. Also, the breach of the duty that is the offshoot of the Berent rationale, and then also the public policy arguments with foreseeability. I just want to reiterate, before I leave Oxman's, that Wisconsin authority, up until the Court of Appeals decision in this case, for holding a corporate officer personally liable within the scope of the employment, was limited to volitional acts or intentional acts. And the Court of Appeals changed that by, in our view, impermissibly extending the rationale of Oxman's to negligent acts. I think we outlined that argument in our briefing, and so I'd like to move on to the questions about foreseeability. And
well, just tell me, what's your basic legal position? Is your basic legal position that a corporate executive or corporate employee, and you can pick your choice, here we're dealing with an executive, is not liable in negligent tort action against third parties? Is that your position? Your position that in this particular case, court should hold as a matter of law he's not liable?
It's the latter, Judge, and to answer the former question, my answer would be it depends. And I think if Mr. Wenham were driving that truck and he happens to be a corporate officer, then clearly.
That's what I would have immediately said.
Correct.
All right.
Correct.
So he wasn't driving the truck, but he gave instructions as to the route. Let's just say he does, for purposes of argument. Gave instructions as to the route, and the route would not comply, and that might be negligence. None of that may hold up. But suppose he were negligent in his corporate position, can he be liable if you have all of the elements of a negligence case?
If Oxman's is going to be extended to negligent behavior.
Oxman had nothing to do with negligent behavior.
Correct.
Right.
We talked about tortious conduct.
That's right. Do you have a case that says that a corporate executive is not liable for negligence?
No, I don't. But I think the follow-up is, in this particular case, based upon the facts in the record, there isn't enough of a causal connection between what Mr. Wenham did in Ohio in approving the route and this accident and the injuries. And believe me, I am mindful.
Enough.
Pardon?
You said there is enough.
There is not enough.
That's what I thought. Should have been saying. All right.
No.
But that's a question for the jury.
Well,
unless as a matter of law, there's no causal relationship.
Typically, it is a question for the jury, but
I'm really just trying to see if your argument is never, never, never can a corporate executive be liable in negligence to a third party, that is someone outside the corporation.
Again, I think it's fact dependent.
So it's possible, is your answer.
It is possible, although the rationale of Oxman's would then have to be extended to negligent acts, because
we haven't had that case. Right. You don't have any case that says it's not.
Correct.
All right.
Correct.
Okay, so we're going to get down to you want it dismissed anyway.
Well, in this particular set of facts, there is not enough of a connection. I don't think it's foreseeable behavior between what Mr. Wenham did and what's in the record, what he did in Ohio in asking employees or having employees prepare a route, trusted employees who used an instrument known to the industry, this DeLorean map maker that gauged miles and speed limits, and then having it approved by the safety department. And it's interesting to know that Mr. Wenham had no contact with Mr. Waring. Didn't ever meet him before this accident, didn't hire him, didn't train him, didn't tell him anything about keeping logbooks. That's all at a different level. And then Mr. Waring, Unfortunately, driving the route on the day of the accident under the influence of narcotics, which obviously have a tendency to increase drowsiness, is involved in this bad accident that has affected the Casper lives and the Janey family. I'm not unmindful of the impact of the injuries in this case, but as an advocate and in analyzing the law, it's our position that there is just not enough of a nexus. And using the Berent decision from 2009, which was the pressure tank case that was modified and turned into a it was unpressurized initially and then became pressurized and unfortunately exploded and caused injury, they determined that there wasn't enough of a connection, that it wasn't foreseeable. And I think that same rationale can be applied to this matter in light of what happened between Wenham looking at the route and approving it and the accident. The other aspect of foreseeability relates to the public policy concern and the remoteness issue. Some of the same argument there about the lack of foreseeability. But this question about a sensible stopping point or the end line of finding Mr. Wenham negligent or open to a negligence claim under the facts of this case, what is the stopping point? Because it's going to have a dramatic effect on corporate Wisconsin and other corporations doing business in this state. Because, in effect, Wenham is made an insurer of employees that he didn't control or supervise or train. Other people in his corporation have done that. And I think that is going to have a dramatic effect on the way corporations react and do business here. And does that mean if Wenham were involved in creating a safety manual and Mr. Waring failed to follow the safety manual about running a red light, Wenham is potentially liable? Is it because Mr. Wenham signs the check that he is on the hook for anybody that is involved in tortious conduct?
What if he wrote the safety manual and it was all wrong?
Well, but then
simply followed, and then the thing explodes.
Assuming that's true, the nexus is clear. I mean, it's a similar example as if Jeff Wenham is driving that truck, or Jeff Wenham is sitting next to Mr. Waring and saying, "You know, speed up, you're running late." That is a clear connection, but it is too strained in this particular set of facts, based upon what we have in the record, to hold Wenham negligent for his approval of the route.
You've got a summary judgment here. That's what the procedural posture is, isn't it?
Correct.
So aren't there any material issues of fact as to what the supervision was, what his relationship with the driver was, and how it extended? I mean, you're dealing with summary judgment.
Well, the two issues that the Court of Appeals identified on summary judgment were the two material issues of fact were this question about the 10-hour route not being done within the 536-mile route not being able to be done within 10 hours, based upon what Mr. Coulter, the Casper's expert, said. And frankly, it has to be a genuine issue of material fact,
sure,
a real issue.
Okay.
And if you look at the record in this case, Coulter's opinion in that matter was based upon a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, and clearly in the record in this case, we see that it was speed limits of 55, 60, and 65, and 70 even. So I think it's mistaken to show that as a material issue. In fact, the other issue, if I may proceed, I see that I'm...
Well, I think you finished answering my question, so I would prefer you not proceed.
All right.
May I...
Justice Prosser has a question.
Thank you.
Mr. Wenham was the chief executive officer of Bestway Systems, Inc.?
Correct.
And Bestway Systems, Inc. is a defendant?
Bestway is a defendant in this case.
Are they still a defendant?
Yes.
What would be the theory of their liability?
Respondeat superior for the acts of Mr. Wenham and, in theory, Mr. Waring, the driver, although he was a leased employee, so TLC also probably has exposure on.
Does Best Way Systems, Inc. have insurance coverage?
Yes. Thank you.
Counsel, Mr. Deutsch, representing Brian Casper.
Members of the court, I'm Alan Deutsch, and I have the honor of representing the Caspers and the Janies, the plaintiffs in this case. I think it's critical to establish two main points concerning Mr. Wenham. One, we are suing him because of his own personal actions. It's immaterial if he was the president, the manager, or the janitor. What is important is his own personal act of approving a route which the evidence shows was illegal. Indeed, if the role of being a corporate officer shielded negligent people in their actions, then every truck driver would become its own corporation and the driver become a president. That's the first thing. Second, we are not suing Mr. Wenham because the driver was on drugs. This was an accident that was totally foreseeable by Mr. Wenham based on his own knowledge and based on what he admitted. It is not an issue of whether he could foresee the truck driver being under the influence. It is an issue of him approving an illegal route that was too long that resulted in a fatigued driver. Indeed, the accident happened in the 11th hour. And the importance of that is he had 10 hours of driving. It's not something that, if it were drugs, it happened in the legal time. It happened at the time when the Federal Motor Carrier Standards clearly show this is fatigued drivers. As Chief Justice pointed out, this is a matter of review of a summary judgment. The facts in the record that hold up that indicate Mr. Wenham was both foreseeable, which is an issue under public policy and under the summary judgment, is that he admitted that he knows, he's familiar with the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations. He even stated that he knows the problems that fatigued drivers can cause. He conceded, as shown on page 9, footnote 4 of his brief, that for the purpose of this motion and appeal, he approved the route.
He's also alleging that he's negligent or that he intentionally acted?
I'm sorry.
Negligence or an intentional tort? Which?
Negligent.
Okay. So anytime someone in a corporation is negligent, they should be able to be individually liable. That's it.
When it is foreseeable in a matter such as this, yes. He was operating under the Federal Motor Carrier Standards. He knew it had to be 10 hours. As our expert said, knowledge of the trucking industry and noted in the appendix, respondent's appendix, he specifically said to do a 536-mile route in 10 hours is practically impossible. Yes, as as was pointed out, that there were some areas where the truck was able to do 65. There's also areas, as our expert points out, where it's doing 5 and 10 miles an hour, that the route goes all the way through Chicago, comes back up into Milwaukee, goes back up into Brown County. It stops in Manitowoc. It stops in Green Bay. It stops in Appleton. So it's doing all that city streets.
Under your theory before, you said it wouldn't matter if he's the president or the janitor. He'd still be individually liable. So if it's the janitor who's negligent, working in the corporation is individually liable, under your theory.
Well, if the janitor approved the route.
Well, the janitor approves how you're going to mop the floors and somebody doesn't put the sign up so somebody slips and falls. That janitor is individually liable now.
That janitor is individually liable if he undertook an action that was negligent.
He didn't make sure somebody put up the slippery floor sign. And someone slipped and fell, and he's at Walmart or wherever working, but he heads up the janitorial department. He's individually liable. His house, his car, his everything is on the line because in his job at Walmart, he didn't make sure somebody put up that sign and somebody slipped and fell. I just want to be clear on
Yes, an example, Your Honor, if the janitor gave the employee who was washing the floors slippery wax and said, here's what you do in this corridor where lots of people keep going down, say, right before Friday of Thanksgiving. I think he's done a negligent act. He said, go make these floors slippery. Then whether he's the president or the janitor, he's liable for his negligent act.
And the company is liable for his negligent act.
I'm sorry,
act.
Your Honor?
And the corporation, the company is liable for his negligent act.
Yes, both are liable.
They're both liable.
That's correct.
You generally don't sue the janitor because he doesn't have money.
That would be correct, I would think, under most cases.
But if he had the money and the corporation was defunct, you'd sue him.
I would suspect you would. I would suspect in any case, Your Honor, good plaintiff's attorney would sue both because, of course, those are not issues that you know at the very beginning. You don't know who's got what, and you proceed against all negligent parties, which makes the most sense here.
Mr. Deutsch, how does the prohibition against suit against a co-employee enter into all of this? My understanding is that traditionally there is protection for negligent acts by a co-employee or co-servant, if you will. How does that fit into all of this?
As I understand, Your Honor, that would be when one employee is suing another employee and you get into workers' comp and those types of issues. This is not. This is an injured party who was injured as a result of an accident that was caused, and it's not a matter of determining the cause, but one of the causes. So a cause of this injury was Mr. Wenham's negligence.
So the co-employee couldn't sue, but the third party can.
Pardon?
The co-employee could not sue the other employee, but a third party could.
Correct. So that given the testimony of the expert, given that the accident happened in the 11th hour, given Mr. Wenham's actions of knowing that he's limited to 10 hours, given, as the expert says, trucks just don't travel that fast. As he said, it's a practical impossibility to do 536 miles in 10 hours, especially when you're stopping on all these city streets, especially you have two metro areas, that is Milwaukee and Chicago. You're transversing not once, but twice, going through them, coming back up into Brown County and back down. With that knowledge, it is clear, Mr. Wenham, that there's evidence in the record that Mr. Wenham should be held negligent, should be held responsible for his own negligence. I would point out to the court quickly on the issues of public policy that this accident is directly related to Mr. Wenham's action. It is not extraordinary. You have a huge truck that he's telling the truck where to go colliding with a minivan. In those types of cases, the minivan's going to lose as a matter of physics, and that's part of the reason why we have the Federal Motor Carrier Standards, Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations that say, here's what you can do and here's what you can't do. There's no basis for fraudulent claims, and as far as a reasonable stopping point, this is not like the case where every member of the public could sue one person. This is the person who was injured in the accident. That one person is suing those people who are negligent. It's the same basis as used in all negligence cases where the negligent party is responsible for his own actions.
So under that theory, counsel, for instance, not too long ago there was an incident in the Gulf Coast. The British Petroleum Company had a well there that developed a leak. So Tony Hayward, the CEO of BP, if he had approved the plans, and those plans turned out to be flawed, each person harmed by the oil or having a claim for the oil leak, every fisherman, every resort owner, every property owner could sue Mr. Hayward personally.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that would be appropriate in that situation for
Why
the
not?
Following reason. In that situation, and that's similar to some of the past rulings in this court, where you have everybody under the sun that could sue him because of the action. That's one of the reasons for the public policy. Here you have only the people who were directly hurt by the accident. The Caspers and the Janies are the only ones that have any right of action against him. It is not as though you're by approving it, you're saying we can sue him for everything. So it would be our position that Mr. Wenham, by the evidence in the record, supports the court in denying the summary judgment, and based thereon, we would ask this court to affirm the ruling of the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Deutsch. Mr. Lauer, you've got 2 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. I'll try to make the first 2 minutes persuasive. We seem to have this fundamental difference about foreseeability, and assuming that Mr. Wenham is going to have potential negligence, which potential liability in this particular case, then the foreseeability issue comes up, and under the particular facts here, there isn't enough of a nexus. I think it's just too remote. Mr. Deutsch conveniently ignores the circumstances of the accident, with Mr. Waring being under the influence of medication, narcotic medication. And that is another factor that, similar to what happened in Barrett or similar to
that may be
what
a superseding factor.
Pardon?
That may be a superseding factor.
Well, it may be a superseding factor, but it further distances what Wenham did in Ohio a year and a half before, relying on people in his company by approving a route without any of this other knowledge. And there isn't anything in the record that Wenham knew that there was a problem with Waring or with this particular route.
Why did he approve it? It's his job to approve it. Isn't it his job? Is he just a rubber stamp? Is that your position?
Well, no. I think he's the CEO, so he's got a responsibility. But under the facts, he's relying on others in his company, and it's not foreseeable that a year and a half later there's going to be an accident because Mr. Waring is under the influence of drugs.
If the accident was 2 days later? No drugs.
I still think that there isn't enough of a connection. It's not foreseeable that that there would be.
That if I choose this route and say it fits within the 10 hours, 5 hours, 55, it's not foreseeable that if it doesn't fit, that you're going to have a fatigued driver more apt to create an accident.
Well, I think under that fact scenario, it may be foreseeable.
Okay.
But this is a different fact situation.
I just wanted to know if there was any fact situation.
What is the authority that would permit the suit directly against the CEO for non-intentional negligence?
Well, if you believe our position, Justice, there isn't authority in Wisconsin because the courts have not given an opinion about holding a corporate officer within the scope of his employment personally liable.
Are there any cases in Wisconsin that allow for the CEO or any other corporate officer to be held personally liable for non-intentional negligent acts?
No, other than the Court of Appeals decision, which just extended Oxman's, in our view.
What about negligent supervision cases and negligent training cases? How do you distinguish those when those are engaged in by officers of the corporation?
Well, I don't think either of those relate to this case.
No, but the question was a much broader question
of whether
or not corporate officers can be held liable for something other than intentional acts. So negligent supervision and negligent training come to mind.
I think I'd have to know how intimately involved the officer is with the supervision or the training because
maybe
it is fact dependent.
Maybe I'm not making myself clear. Can, under the appropriate facts, a cause of action be maintained against a corporate officer for negligent supervision or negligent training?
I don't think so under the current state of the law in Wisconsin. I think a corporate officer acting within the scope of his duties, there has not been a case finding him liable, him or her liable, for
negligent training or negligent supervision or negligent hiring.
For non-intentional types of torts.
Wasn't Oxman's based on a alleged misrepresentation by the president of the corporation?
Willful and intentional misrepresentation, so an intentional tort. Yes.
Thank you, counsel. Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel. I want to thank all the counsel involved, Mr. Weiss, Mr. Anderson, Mr. Lauer, and Mr. Deutsch, for their excellent arguments today in a case involving numerous difficult corporate and negligent tort actions. That concludes our hearing in 06 AP 1229, 06 AP 2512, 07 AP 369, generally referred to as Casper versus American International South Insurance Company. The students, if they will remain, Justice Prosser will be willing and able to talk with you for several minutes if you have the time, and the court will meet back in closed conference at 3:20. We are adjourned for oral arguments. And